Well, good afternoon. Welcome to warm and sunny Atlanta, I think, as Senator Chambliss said this morning. And we're expecting a little more weather activity, which for farmers and ranchers is always a wonderful thing. We love the weather. That's why we take up the profession. We are looking forward to, I think, a pretty good time at this convention, notwithstanding whatever issues the weather may create with some individuals coming in to be on our program. But our members are pretty much going to all be here, and they were pretty much all not going to leave till after this little system moves through, so we're going to be confined for the duration and take care of our business as an organization. I try to keep this fairly informal. I don't have much in the way of opening comments. I think many of you heard my comments this morning at the annual meeting. I could reiterate that the issues I talked about with respect to overregulation, mostly by EPA, but they're not the sole culprit, are issues that are of great concern to farmers and that we plan on working on pretty extensively in this year of 2011. We do have the farm bill to deal with. All indications are that Chairman Lucas will move a little bit slower than what past Chairman Peterson indicated he was going to do, so the bulk of that debate may occur in 2012, but I think there will be a lot of preparatory work. There will be a lot of work, I think, on behalf of organizations representing producers about what we want that farm bill to look like. We will have some of that work occur here in our delegate session on Tuesday. We are having our own internal discussion about what's the appropriate way to use scarce dollars with the farm bill. I don't have any predictions about how that's going to come out. Stay tuned. We'll know about that Tuesday afternoon. But our members are cognizant of the budget difficulties we'll face with this farm bill, and they're also cognizant of the current structure and where the deficiencies are there, and they're going to look at ways to decide the policies that we need to have to move forward for the future. Sort of from a societal standpoint, the critics that have been attacking modern production agriculture are there. Their voices have been getting more strident, louder. We have more consumers who don't understand much about agriculture that are being swayed by some of those discussions and critiques, and that is the purpose of the creation of the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, which I spoke of this morning. We are moving forward as an organization to do exactly what we said we were going to do. We're going to put together a sustained national program funded at a level that will have an impact on consumers' perception, positive impact. That process is underway now in terms of developing that, and I expect by the second quarter of 2011 there'll be more substance, if you will, and knowledge about how we're going to move forward and what the particular messages are going to be and where the targeted where the targets are going to be in terms of primarily people who influence consumers. That will probably be the primary target. I do want to point out, because I know I've had a lot of questions about, well, you know, what are y'all going to say about the farm bill, and what are you going to say about ethanol, and what are you going to say about all this other stuff? Well, we're not going to say anything about all that. The Alliance will not be doing the traditional policy things. What we're going to do is a communications campaign related to building and maintaining consumer trust in today's American agriculture. I know you're going to have a lot of questions, so I think I will just close it here. We are still expecting, by the way, Secretary Vilsack to make it in. His staff has been monitoring the weather and trying to figure out if he can get in and out of here. And right now, we're still expecting Secretary Vilsack to be with us tomorrow afternoon for our closing session. And our keynote speaker, Mike Rowe, also, we're expecting him to be here. So all in all, things are looking pretty good. What kind of questions we have? Yes, sir.
Ray Henry, AP. About the lawsuit that you mentioned today, when do you expect to file that? In which district court, federal, state? And last, if you could just explain, you talked about that those Chesapeake Bay rules that have been proposed starving agriculture out of that area. What's sort of the nexus between those regulations and the economic harm? What specific impacts are you worried about for your members?
Well, I'll speak in a general sense. First, to get the answer to your question, we're expecting to file tomorrow, January 10th, in the Federal District Court for the Middle District of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania Farm Bureau will be joining us. We do expect that after some time we'll have some other entities join us in this lawsuit. Our concern has been that the way EPA is proposing to move forward with this diet, if you will, pollution diet or restricting total maximum daily loads, the way they're laying that program out, in that essence, it's a pollution diet for the whole Chesapeake Bay, and there will be a tendency, both for economic reasons and also as a result of what we believe are flawed studies, that indicate agriculture is this huge problem, and therefore the cost burden is going to come straight down on agriculture in that 64,000 square mile area. And obviously, if you put too much of a cost burden on it, you're not going to have that agriculture occurring there. And so that's been our concern all along. Specifically, though, we believe that EPA moving forward in the manner they are violates the Clean Water Act. And we'll be making the arguments to prove that. And we think that their process has already violated the Administrative Procedures Act. So those will be the things that we will be briefing in the lawsuit.
Mr. Stallman, Ron Hayes, Radio Oklahoma Network. One thing you didn't mention this morning, but I know on the mind of several of your producers, your cattle producer, the Eastern livestock situation. What is Farm Bureau? Have you had a chance to have any dialogue with USDA or GIPSA about how they've handled it to this point, and your thoughts about how maybe to make sure something like this doesn't happen in the future?
Well, not specifically. We have not. I mean, we're aware of the situation. We're aware of the damage, frankly, that will be done to a lot of producers that are going to be left hung without getting paid. But, you know, that really falls under the current regulatory structure, and USDA is going to have to deal with that. We haven't weighed in on that. I'm not sure. I can't stand up here and tell you that the new proposed GIPSA rules are going to help in that particular situation. I don't know. I can't tell you that. But we haven't engaged in that from an organizational standpoint.
Chris Clayton with DTN. What do you understand from your own resolutions that have been filed are going to be the big pieces of debate on Tuesday on the floor?
Well, I knew somebody was going to ask me that question, Chris, and I'll be honest with you, I don't predict commodity prices, the weather, the outcome of political races, or precisely what our delegates are going to do. They have a mind of their own. Having said that, I have watched the policy process unfold thus far this year. We are going to have some discussion about the Farm Bill, and there will be discussion about direct payments versus revenue insurance. I am hoping, as I said in my annual address this morning, that we do get more specific priorities and sort of direction than what we have now about the choices that are going to have to be made, given the tight budget situation we're in. It remains to be seen what the delegates will do. I know we've had the discussion, and we'll have more discussion on the dairy policy. That has been a big element internally, and we had some of the discussion last year at our annual meeting. So, you know, what the new dairy policy should look like also will be discussed. We had thus far some interesting discussions on how to move forward with renewable fuels, ethanol particularly. What do you do with the blending credit versus infrastructure? There's two competing schools of thought, basically, that you need to maintain the blend credit, you need to maintain the tariff, or the alternative is to, well, let's move those kind of resources into the blend pumps and more infrastructure to increase usage, as opposed to, you know, having those credits and tariffs in place. I expect we'll have some debate on that. In a lot of other areas, I am sure we're going to have some discussion, things like OIE, the standards related to beef for international trade. We've had this kind of negotiation that we've done with Korea, we've tried to do with other countries about how do you get beef into their market under the current OIE standards versus their desire to have less than full OIE compliance. And so I think we're still interested in maintaining that international standard, which in essence says that if you do have an interim agreement to, say, provide beef at 30 months or less as opposed to all beef, that still, if we're going to do that, at some point you have to have acknowledgement that there should be a date at which those countries will accept full OIE standards, those kind of things. We've had some discussion on that. Immigration, border security, the need for an agricultural guest worker program is obviously still there. The need for reforming the H-2A program is still there. I think our policy has been pretty strong in those two areas. We have had more discussion about the need to strengthen border security, that that should also be a component of our policy, which I don't know that there's anybody that believes that a country shouldn't be able to control their borders, but we might have some discussion about that. All of the regulatory issues that we're engaged in, we already have pretty good existing policy. I actually think us filing this lawsuit relative to the Chesapeake Bay situation both carries out existing policy but also precludes us from having further discussion about more specifics about what we're going to do in that area, because there was a strong feeling amongst our leaders that the path EPA was going down was not only going to affect the Chesapeake Bay, but it was going to affect other watersheds across the country. That's about all I can think of right now. I expect it to be an interesting session. It always is. I enjoy chairing it. And I'm sure our delegates will come up with some topics to talk about that I can't even think about standing up here at the podium.
Roger Ward, WLDS. Mr. Stallman, you just mentioned the lawsuit. As we look at some of the EPA, what other policy remedies could be implemented? Is it an administration, or is it going to be a congressional type of action that you would pursue relative to try and get some relief from these EPA regulations?
We'll use any mechanism we can, whether it's legislative or the regulatory process or litigation. I guess in general, the election with the Republican-controlled House insulates us now a little bit from having further legislative attempts to put in place burdensome regulations. I'm talking about things like cap and trade for controlling greenhouse gases, or maybe an expansion of the Clean Water Act, you know, to change navigable waters to all waters of the United States. So I think that provides us some insulation, but that's defense. Offensively, to pass some legislation to correct some of these things is still going to be difficult. We may get bills passed in the House to accomplish some of the things we'd like to, and restricting EPA's activities. And just take, for an instance, the NPDES rule about permitting spray nozzles or application of pesticides over water. We will still try to seek bipartisan agreements to restrict that type of regulation. But passing that legislation is going to be more difficult, because obviously you not only have to pass the House, you have to get by a Senate, which is still controlled by the Democrats, and you still have to have a presidential signature. So that's how I kind of view the landscape. Now, there can be opportunities with appropriations to restrict funding for implementation of a lot of these regulations. That's a path that we will pursue also. So I think we have a lot of opportunities and avenues, but there's nothing that's a magic bullet out there to actually roll back or restrict, what's already in the regulatory arena now.
At one of your conferences here, Jeff Downey with the Cromwell Ag Network, I talked to the commissioner, the former commissioner of Ag in Florida, that says they were making improvements in the waters of their state, and that some of the standards the EPA now have asked them to meet are unattainable. And the commissioner from Texas has suggested if they implement what the EPA asked, their environment will worsen rather than improve. How is this an example of what you've seen over the last so many months, and what's important about stopping it here before it spreads as a standard across the rest of the states?
Well, it's much easier to stop something from expanding, particularly in terms of regulation, than it is to pull it back once it gets out there. I mean, that's number one. But the extent to which, and part of the problem in a lot of the EPA regulatory issues, is to the extent EPA can, in essence, coerce because of their delegated authority to the states, can coerce states into doing things that those states probably wouldn't be doing on their own. And so that tends to be an issue, too, and that's a huge issue in the Chesapeake Bay situation. So I'm not quite sure about your question, Jeff, but in terms of how you try to stop it, the sooner the better, because once you get out into the states, and I'm not sure about the Texas situation where you're saying that our commissioner down there, I say our commissioner, I still live in the state, has said that it would make the environment worse. If they followed the EPA standards. I'm not sure about the details of that.
Is EPA using sound science for their threshold? Is it sound science?
We don't think so in terms of accomplishing environmental goals. I mean, we have said all along that too much of this is sort of a command and control regulatory structure that's based on, in this administration, the desires of the environmental community. Whereas if you really want to accomplish good works with agriculture and the environment, you do it the way we've always done it. You do it with voluntary incentive-based programs, of which there are many and of which many producers participate in. We believe agriculture has done a pretty good job of honoring their obligation to the environment, to water, to the soil. Can there be more done? Yes. But that more done should be in the terms of voluntary incentive-based plans, as we have done in the past with the many conservation programs that exist, for instance, under the Farm Bill.
On the subject of EPA and that lawsuit, one of the things the Obama administration said when they rolled out the Chesapeake Bay rules, for example, is that they were doing this federally because they had seen that the, I think, five or six states in that region plus D.C., in their view, had not made adequate progress in controlling nitrate pollution and other contaminants in the bay. In your remarks, it seemed like you were suggesting that you felt that this should be a state issue, state regulation of agriculture, as opposed to an EPA issue. What about that dynamic? What about in this lawsuit where you have a situation where you have multiple state entities? I mean, was it appropriate for EPA to get involved when you sort of have multiple state governments in the periphery of that bay?
Well, first, the Clean Water Act allows states to decide how to improve water quality, and it also allows them to take into account economic and social impacts. What EPA was doing, we believe, was just overriding all of that. And, you know, I can't quote the exact figures, but if you look at the Chesapeake Bay and the contentions that the Chesapeake Bay is getting worse, agriculture, when the Chesapeake Bay was supposedly better, constituted a much greater industry sector and much greater activity across the land of the Chesapeake Bay when the Chesapeake Bay was supposed to be better. And now that it's gotten worse, there seems to be some kind of tendency to blame agriculture, and yet the development factor under these rules is going, or the development, all the development that has occurred, we believe, has contributed to a lot more of that pollution. And then the way EPA is proposing those TMDL rules, in essence, it was going to put agriculture in the position of bearing a cost burden that they weren't going to be able to bear, and that development probably would over the diet, if you will, there'd be an allocation, and the diet of that would go toward development as opposed to agriculture. That's why we think agriculture is going to be forced out economically, and we don't think that's going to accomplish, first, what people want to do with cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay, and we support cleaning up the Chesapeake Bay, and we think agriculture can play a role in that. But that's not the way EPA is going about structuring the rules.
With AgWired. You mentioned USFRA in your remarks this morning, the new organization of different agricultural groups around the country. It's still a baby organization, only just a couple of months old at this point. Can you give us an update of how many organizations have joined USFRA at this point, if there's any holdouts, and really, you know, I mean, you're just getting started about this. Like you said, you're talking about unity and agriculture in the same sentence, and you know, what are your hopes and dreams as far as that's concerned?
Yeah. I'll give you a personal perspective, and that it's been amazing how all of the groups and the leaders in the groups have come together. And everybody just jumps in and works and does different things. I mean, we've been doing that before we were officially formed, and we were officially formed November 5th. Since that time, we've been full bore running to set up an administrative structure with a contractor, which we've accomplished. We're in the process of putting out RFPs for a legal counsel. We're in process of developing, we have a communications group developing a communications plan with strategies, with goals, and then strategies to achieve those goals. The board has approved those. The next step is to translate that into, in essence, a request for information from communications firms that we that think they can, you know, carry out those strategies and goals. So we'll be engaged in that process. We have another group that's been working on the fundraising and resource aspects of this, and we fully expect that the we'll attempt to get resources from all across the agricultural food sector. We've already had a lot of interest from our suppliers, equipment suppliers, input suppliers, and processors. So we're in that stage now of starting to develop the funding necessary to carry this out, and we expect that by the second quarter of 2011 that that we will be putting out the beginnings of our communications effort, and then we hope to carry that out over a 3 to 5 year period at a magnitude that will really make a difference in terms of what consumer perceptions are. At a minimum, inoculate consumers from all the misleading information that they get from the of the critics of today's American agriculture. Stuart.
Stuart Doan, AgriPulse. Secretary Vilsack's coexistence discussion, bringing together stakeholders, some of them kicking and screaming to the table to talk about basically turning a deregulation of a biotech product, in this case Roundup Ready alfalfa, into a negotiation. Is that, in your view, an example of overregulation, number one? Number two, Farm Bureau signed on to a letter middle of last week with a number of other commodity groups complaining about this approach to Dr. John Holdren, White House science advisor. How hopeful are you that you will gain some support from the White House and others in the administration to kill what appears to be a proxy for setting geographical distances and isolation distances for planting of biotech crops?
Well, we've staked out our position. We think where USDA is talking about going sort of exceeds their mandate under the Plant Protection Act. There were basically three options, I think, that USDA put out in terms of the specific issue of regulating the biotech alfalfa. One was, not deregulating. One was full deregulation, and one was that third option where you have deregulation with restrictions, which gets to the buffers and the things that you're talking about. It's not overregulation yet because they haven't done it. However, we are very concerned about that approach. We think that science needs to drive these decisions. I've spoken with Secretary Vilsack about it, talked to him about in fact, we sent our own letter in addition to being part of the group letter, talked to him about our concerns. It's essential for the future of biotechnology and regulation that we maintain a, science-based approach, look at human health and safety, safety of the environment, and then these sort of socioeconomic issues which are being raised in this particular discussion, that should not be a part of the regulatory structure of biotechnology because, and I've spent a good deal of time running around the world talking to these other governments that want to restrict the use of biotechnology, that you can't use a political system, which is socioeconomic basically, you can't use a political system to regulate these kind of things, frankly, under, we believe, WTO rules. And so it's going to be a lot harder for me to go around the world making the case that it needs to be based on science and not politics if we're turning around and doing that right here. The jury's still out as to what they're going to come out with. I'm hopeful that it will be based on science. The environmental impact statement that came back indicated that there was no factor under the Plant Protection Act that would cause it to be regulated. But we'll have to see how USDA handles that. We wanted to be sure that we were on the record as to our concerns about that approach, as other groups have been also. And so I guess we'll have to wait and see.
When you talk about the cost burden, you guys are weighing into a battle that has been well-funded on the other side for a long time. When we look at what's happening in California, the situation in Iowa, Florida's requirements are being pushed by environmental folks who have fairly deep pockets. How are we going to fund that?
Well, you're talking about the environmental, the EPA regulation. Are you well, okay, let me get straight which part we're talking about here. We have a lot of challenges. Are you talking about the consumer perception side or the regulatory side? Both. Okay. The consumer perception side is you know, it's different than how you fight the regulatory side. They're kind of connected because in a democracy, you know, citizens vote and consumers are citizens. But the consumer perception side is really about informing, we believe, consumers about the benefits of today's American agriculture, which sort of gets left out of the critics' mantra about how bad today's American agriculture is. They don't talk about the benefits. And so we believe that with a targeted, well-funded effort that has the scope and duration that we think we can achieve, that we can make a difference in terms of how consumers view today's American agriculture. When you sit down with an individual that doesn't know anything about agriculture and explain what we do, why we did it. I've done it personally, and others have too. Other farmers and ranchers have too, and we think that's good, but we need to get to a broader market, and that's what that effort's about. In terms of regulation, you have to have deep pockets to go into the courthouse. Litigation costs money. We think that the legislative approach is obviously one we'll never ignore and we'll always pursue. But when you start fighting regulatory actions in court, that takes money. That's why there are coalitions put together from our side, if you will, on these regulatory fights to try to come up with the resources to do that. We have been in the AFBF, specifically, has been in the courthouse for a long time. We fought many battles. We know what the costs are, but we also know that we have to be there when you have an agency that is not that is expanding the scope of a law beyond where it was intended. You have to challenge them, because otherwise you'll get this continual expansion, and that's really what we're going to continue doing.
Is there?
You're asking me a question that is way outside my expertise. We have good general counsel in our general counsel's office in our shop. We have good external counsel, and I'd have to leave it to the attorneys to figure those kind of things out. Let me see, Jeff, if there's anybody else. Yeah, go ahead.
Mitch Lees, Capital Press. I'm just wondering, you know, can you have, is the Farm Bill solely for the deregulation of the biotech, you were saying alfalfa in this case, or could you have a limited regulation, you know, based on science, you know, which would have the buffers and that the Farm Bureau would back?
Well, I normally don't do hypotheticals, but in this case, since the environmental impact statement didn't indicate there was any problem from a science base with any of the health and safety or environmental issues, we wouldn't be supportive of doing anything other than following the provisions of the Plant Protection Act. I'll tell you, I on my farm for the past 2 years, probably not going to happen this year, we've grown organic rice. I've let my cousin grow organic rice. And, you know, I know what the provisions are that you have to deal with as an organic rice grower, and you have conventional crops grown across the fence. Our policy in Farm Bureau is pretty clear in that if you're growing a crop for which you get a premium over conventional production, and you derive that premium because of the restrictions on the way you produce that, then you should be responsible for meeting those restrictions, whatever they are, because you get a premium for your crop. And so that's kind of how we divide up this issue. We have organic growers, non-biotech growers, biotech growers within our organization, large and small. We have it all. But we're going to try to convince USDA in this specific instance with alfalfa that we need to maintain or follow the provisions of the Plant Protection Act and be very narrow about how we apply the science-based approach that we have used in this country before. Sarah.
Thank you. Sarah Wyatt with AgriPulse. You outlined several success stories that American agriculture has had over the last few years, as well as outlining several threats that lie ahead. But if you were to isolate and rank those in terms of what you see as the biggest threat facing the success of our industry in 2011, what would that be?
I keep coming back to regulatory cost and regulatory restrictions that are burdensome to the extent that you make it difficult to produce food, fiber, and fuel in this country. Are we there yet? No, obviously, because we're still doing a good job of producing. We're exporting. We have a very viable industry. But there could be a time, because there are those in the society that don't want today's American agriculture to exist. They have a philosophy that somehow, regardless of the fact that they buy modern electronics, the most up-to-date computers, iPod, the newest car, somehow they want their food produced by technology that was used 50 years ago. And, there's a disconnect there. But I think the biggest challenge we face is going to be, the regulatory structure that is either demanded by society or that is put in place by those who are philosophically opposed to what we do as an industry. And I think the biggest battles in 2011, for the most part, are going to be regulatory. I didn't want to get into the potential weather problems and volatility in prices that I think are going to occur. That's a totally different ballpark, and I don't predict commodity prices. But I think we could have some real challenges in certain sectors anyway, particularly in this coming 2011 year with volatility, given the particular supply situation we're in and potentially a weather situation that we could be in. But, all of us in agriculture know we'll have to wait and see what the weather does to us.
Gary DiGiuseppe, Arkansas Radio Network. Two quick questions. How'd your organic rice come out? And are you hearing anything about NPDES? I had a state regulator tell me that EPA may still seek extension of the deadline from the courts.
My organic rice, unfortunately, my cousin had to take most of the burden of that this past year. Didn't come out very well. The year before, turned out okay. Right now, as you probably know, Gary, the organic rice market isn't all that great. But regardless of that, that's personal. What was the second question? Oh, yeah, NPDES. The schedule is for those rules to go in place, I believe, April 9th. We certainly support any extension of those rules. We think, number one, the states are going to have a very difficult time complying with the delegated authority to issue those permits. That's going to be a real problem for producers who could be at risk of citizen lawsuits, particularly, if they don't have a permit, the liability of putting out pesticides through a spray nozzle over or near water without having one of those permits, I think, is going to create a real problem. So we certainly support an extension. We actually go beyond that. We support basically a legislative repeal of that, and there will be legislation introduced to help accomplish that, and we will be supportive of that. But right now, the best we could hope for in the short term is to get an extension. I had the question about the alliance. I want to go back. I forgot to tell you, we have 23 groups. And they're all the major agricultural groups right now that are involved with the alliance, and we are expecting more. So I neglected to talk about that. Yeah.
Dan Looker with Successful Farming Magazine. How much money will Farm Bureau be kicking into the alliance? Do you know yet?
Yeah, whatever my board says, we will. We do expect to be financially supportive, though. No. Sorry.
Lee. There's talking about the challenges and the weather, the volatility, but there's good things happening in agriculture, the alliance, and there are some good grain prices right now, good cotton prices. So where's the optimism? You've got optimism for our members and for our farmers across this country, right?
Well, absolutely. Hopefully all my comments didn't indicate that I was totally pessimistic, but from a financial standpoint, the agricultural industry sector is one of the strongest positions we've been in. 2011, notwithstanding something that could happen relative to weather, particularly that could hit certain sectors, I think we're looking for a good year in 2011. Debt-to-asset ratios are, I guess, right at record levels, if not at record low levels for agriculture. That's a positive. I mean, we're a bright, shining star in the United States economy in terms of an industry sector that will create maybe a different dynamic in this farm bill debate than what we have had at other times. But the reality is, and you got to be careful in an agricultural producer organization about saying times are good. Farmers are not inclined to say times are good. But there's some good times in the aggregate out there. I'll say that much. So I'm very positive about that. I'm positive about agriculture as an industry in this country. When you look at the necessity of by 2050 to have to feed 2.3 billion more people, increase food production by 70% on what is essentially the same arable land base, and we are the ones that have the technology and the productivity increases to help play a role in that, I think the future is bright if we can just keep sort of that societal burden from being placed on us for no good reason other than philosophical. I think things are pretty good all in all. But we always have to pay attention to those challenges that can undermine the economic positives that are out there by putting these burdens on us.
About this new Congress, despite the challenges that we think we might have with, with the Farm Bill, but the new Congress, just speak to it, if you would.
Well, particularly the new House of Representatives or the new leadership there, I think it's going to be much easier to keep bad legislation from being passed. I mean, that's the positive thing. Having said that, we still have, as I think I've already said, we have a challenge passing challenge passing legislation to change things we want changed, but just the ability not to have things get worse, which I think we have that opportunity now, is a real positive too. These next 2 years are going to be real interesting from a political and legislative standpoint. And this last election was when we had change in 2008. We've had change in 2010, and I don't know, we may have more change in 2012. But, we have to deal with whatever the politics are at the time. We have to work on policy, and that's what we do as an organization. It doesn't matter who's in charge. But right now, I see some positives in this Congress with this House, but then I also see that they have a huge fiscal situation to deal with in this country, and that's going to be difficult for all of us as citizens. Jeff.
Bob, thoughts on two areas, E-15 litigation and 1099s under the health care?
Well, Farm Bureau is staying out of the E-15 litigation. It is there. It is groups that perhaps are not as inclined to be supportive of renewable fuels, and the announcement about moving to a partial deregulation, if you will, up to E-15. We'll have to see how those lawsuits play out. We were supportive of moving to the E-15 level, but we're not engaged in the lawsuits. The 1099 reporting, and it's in the current health care law, we have been supporting an amendment to repeal that. We will continue to support an amendment to repeal that. It's the silliest thing in the world. Anybody that's ever done accounting at the farm level, can you imagine the 1099s that you're going to have to write to all the people that you're writing checks to? It is ludicrous because it's not going to accomplish a thing. All it's going to do is create a lot of additional paperwork and cost burden. And so we'll continue to try to get that carved out. I'm hoping that can happen. I'm a little bit optimistic that can happen, but it needs to happen. One more? Who hadn't had one yet? Anybody hadn't had one that wants one? Yes.
Yes. Oh. I'm sorry. I came in late because I was covering another one of your events. I hope nobody has asked this, but I wonder, where do you see the debate going over the GPSA rule?
Actually, no one has asked that, Jerry. Okay. So you're in the clear. you know, USDA received, what, 70,000 comments on the GPSA rule or something like that? I expect them to spend some time assessing what all those comments say and then probably come out with an amended rule, I guess. That's the best I can tell you. We have filed our comments as an organization. We found positives in the GPSA rule, and there were some negatives in the GPSA rule, and we pointed all those out very carefully. Obviously, there are groups that have talked about legal action once the rule is put in place, and you know, I guess we'll have to wait and see what the details of the rule are going to be when it finally gets implemented. All right, well, thank you all for coming. I hope all of you are going to stay around and enjoy the rest of our annual meeting and our delegate session, which will be all day Tuesday. I always enjoy that. Look forward to an interesting debate by our members. Thank you. And the weather.